This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Bernie Sanders plays his last card in the presidential race and officially endorses nominee Hillary Clinton.
Secretary Clinton has won the Democratic nominating process. And I congratulate her for that.
With Hillary Clinton standing by, the event in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, signifies that Hillary Clinton's desk is cleared now for a coronation convention in Philadelphia, and then on to the general election to face Donald Trump. This day also signifies that Bernie Sanders can now play Pokemon Go for the rest of the summer if he wants. He won't need any cards for that. The Sanders footprints, though, remain on the Democratic Party platform, his endorsement of the minimum wage, his opposition to the death penalty, and continued Wall Street reform. But Hillary Clinton will hold fast to her support of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, two key policies where Sanders and Clinton see eye to eye are higher education and health care, and they're both in the platform. What will we learn between now and November? Well, whether the Sanders phenom is a full-fledged political movement or just a wing of the Democratic Party. Nomiki Konst has an opinion on this. She's a host of The Filter on Sirius XM Progress, a Bernie Sanders supporter and a member of the Democratic Platform Committee. She joins me now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nomi, how was, first of all, the meeting in the platform committee? Was this all friendly stuff? Endorsement today means that everyone's just hugging?
Oh, yeah. Sure. we're out to go get some ice cream. It was a tough meeting. The hours were very long. Let's start with that. People were up until 2, 3 in the morning trying to pass these amendments. The debate was a very hearty debate over the soul of the Democratic Party, from making $15 minimum wage the standard for the Democratic Party to ending TPP, which our side, the Sanders side, lost that fight. We had some major environmental, huge success on environmental issues, from creating some sort of regulations on fracking provisions, which is a really big thing in a very organized area of the Democratic Party right now, where there's a lot of activists pushing on the Democratic Party. But, you know, I personally don't think it went far enough. And I think that in the meetings, we saw that even some Hillary supporters started to break away from their leader in where the Democratic Party is to go. The biggest issue, I think, that is not being reported on is campaign finance reform. While in the platform there is a call to end super PACs, there were multiple amendments that were just voted down unanimously on the Hillary Clinton side. So, you know, there's still some tension. I think that this is a good step towards unifying the party. I don't know if all of the Bernie Sanders supporters, especially the more active and vocal ones, will be on board just yet. And I think that's up to Hillary. I don't think it's up to Bernie. Symbolism hasn't worked so far. Elizabeth Warren didn't bring in Bernie Sanders supporters. Katy Perry didn't bring in a millennial woman. This is up to Hillary to go out there and listen and put an ear on the ground of the Progressive Party. This party is 70% more progressive than it was 10 years ago.
What does that mean, though?
It means that the country's changing. The demographics are shifting
rapidly. In specific numbers, what does that mean? 70% more progressive.
70%. When you poll the Democratic Party membership, you know, there's issues that you poll them on from 10 years ago to today. You know, it's almost unanimous that Democrats agree that same-sex marriage should be the standard, right? That we should have economic policies that reflect the recession. We should learn from our mistakes of the recession. So I think the recession was really the point where the Democratic Party went back to the party of FDR, the membership. At the platform meetings, over and over and over again, that is what I heard where the divide was. It was among the Wall Street Democrats and the more fiscally progressive FDR populist Democrats.
Would you say Hillary Clinton represents the Wall Street Democrats?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific mm-hmm. Trade Partnership, because was there any discussion, since really from this point on it's all about Trump, or it's all about beating Trump, Hillary Clinton beating Trump, was there any discussion of taking TPP off the table by opposing TPP in the same way that Trump opposes TPP would deny Trump an issue, that it would be strategically right. welcome, even if later on they suddenly have a change of heart?
I think it was the biggest mistake that we made at the platform meetings.
Was there discussion of it,
though? There was a major discussion. There were some amendments proposed. Jim Hightower proposed a pretty detailed amendment. And the Saunders amendment from the Hillary side was a more vague amendment. And so Ben Jealous, who is the former head of the NAACP, proposed a secondary amendment which would clarify the language to the Saunders Amendment, specifically saying, and that is why we do not support TPP. And that launched a hearty debate between both sides. And I think the major argument on the Sanders side was that Donald Trump and the RNC are taking TPP out of their platform. They want to win Rust Belt states to go against TPP as a party. With that, you not only have an edge over Donald Trump in getting those Rust Belt blue-collar white voters, but you also are able to engage the Sanders supporters that you so desperately need. And they denied it. It was politically, I think, a poor move.
Emotionally, at this moment, Barack Obama is going to be in Dallas. The idea of racial violence and police violence is huge right now. Mm-hmm. What do you think Sanders feels about stepping back at this particular moment? Can Hillary lead in the way that Barack Obama may try to lead today in Dallas?
I think that's up to Hillary to decide. I do know that Senator Sanders will still be engaged throughout the campaign as well as his surrogates. I think that there are several movements that have fallen under Senator Sanders' campaign, from some Black Lives Matter members who've been organizing to union members. There's so many different movements, and those movements will continue. In fact, I think that under a Hillary Clinton presidency, those movements will be more successful than under a Donald Trump presidency. So I really do hope that Secretary Clinton has her ear on the ground, is listening to these movements, because it's not about symbolism. It's not about politics right now. I don't really think that Bernie Sanders supporters really care if they show up at a rally. I think they just want their issues addressed.
Namiki Konst is a host of The Filter on SiriusXM Progress and is a, as you can tell, Bernie Sanders supporter. Thanks so much, Namiki.
Thank you so much.
Juba in South Sudan is in chaos today as the international community watches a rebellion take hold in that city. Media reports cite attacks across the city, and local embassies are calling for evacuation of non-critical personnel. The stormy 5 years since South Sudan became the world's newest nation has it holding on once again. A peace deal has all but collapsed, and speaking from Kenya, the U.S. Ambassador Robert Godek has called for a regional peace effort.
They must stop the violence. They must restore peace. We cannot stand by as an international community as this country, South Sudan, is plunged back into violence.
The violence comes from troops loyal to President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar, who began shooting at each other in the streets earlier this week. Nakdora Dwayne Bassey is founder of the American School of South Sudan. She's speaking to us here from the United States, had been planning to go back to South Sudan. Nak, what are your plans at this point?
It's really hard to tell. I have two young kids, a four-year-old and a one-year-old, and it's very hard for me and my husband to decide to take them back into that kind of situation. I'm just a recent graduate. I graduated in May, so we're trying to re-pivot and figure out what's the best steps for not just me, but for the family as a whole.
What are you hearing from essentially what you hope to be your home?
This is really hard times, and it's very sad. It's a bit of deja vu from December 2013 when South Sudan broke out into civil war initially. But what I'm hearing from friends and family is most people are just under their beds, scared, waiting for the fighting to pass so they have the opportunity to flee.
And the children in South Sudan have not benefited from much education over this five-year period. What do you expect for your own family if you were to return there? There has not been a sustained period of tranquility to begin the process of developing educational institutions and all of that.
That is true. The educational institutions are very weak. But I am a big believer that if there's peace, or if there's an opportunity for people to build livelihoods and build schools and actually be able to just have a chance at life, things can happen. I mean, that's how the American School came into fruition. And even when I was there in Juba, I had my two-year-old there. It wasn't the best. She was in the school. She was getting education. She was learning her ABCs, her 1-2-3s. So if there is peace and sustainability, things can happen. Things can develop. But when it's in chaos, it's very, very difficult to do anything.
I guess I'm wondering if you share my frustration that South Sudan should be such a challenge. I mean, nothing's easy in the world of diplomacy and finding peace. These are internal conflicts. They're not conflicts with the North, and they're not necessarily conflicts over the oil resources in South Sudan. Why can't peace hold, you know, at this point in time?
I definitely think currently our two leaders, Riek Machar, our president, and our first vice president, are really, really taking the country into a dangerous direction. And it's unfortunate that so many civilians, young women, children, and older individuals are feeling the brunt of this and suffering. And what I definitely believe is that we need a new generation of leaders to actually take South Sudan into a new direction. We have so much work to do in terms of just developing ourselves as a nation after 22 years of civil war with Sudan. We should not be putting on further issues, further problems in terms of violence and chaos, where we cannot ever have that chance to actually have livelihoods and support ourselves and actually get South Sudan to the status of where it needs to be, where the citizens can just live and prosper, and their children can live and prosper.
When you and your husband talk about the future, and when you talk with other people from South Sudan, how much time do you think you have?
This is going to be a lifelong journey, and I don't know if it's going to be necessarily in my generation, but I definitely believe that if we can just have good leadership that can allow peace and development. So, yes, it's going to take time, but if we can just have peace where people are not being killed, where our leaders are not battling over power, where there's not two armies in the capital city causing intense issues into a region that where people actually just want to develop and have peace.
Who can negotiate between these two leaders, and what's the chance that there would be power sharing between them? And what's the danger that young people in Juba, you know, leave the idea of peace and instead join this armed struggle that you describe as being pointless? But since school is out, the alternative to, you know, become the militia of your own neighborhood is there in front of every teenage boy.
It's a very real and a very hard circumstance that is a thin line between going back into full-fledged civil war and losing South Sudan for some years to come, or it is a time for the citizens to reclaim their country, and meaning that we have to be clear that our leaders currently are failing us, and we have to have a voice, and we have to have it loud, and say that this is the time where a new generation of leaders are going to come and develop South Sudan and do what we can to make a difference. It's very hard to know what the future will hold, but I'm a firm believer, and a lot of the conversations I've had with my friends, my colleagues, and it's the same narrative. We have to stop talking about the failed leadership. What is it that we can do to ensure that there is the right leadership that will take this country to prosperity?
Naknor Dwanibasi is founder of the American School of South Sudan, is awaiting the moment to return and become a part of that new generation of leadership. Thank you so much, Nak.
Thank you.
I am honored and humbled to have been chosen by the Conservative Party to become its leader.
That's right. The Tories find a taker, finally, and the UK moves a new leader into number 10 Downing Street in London to replace the resigning David Cameron, who bet his political future on the EU and lost. Theresa May, out of the Conservative Party chaos, has emerged to be sworn in as the first female prime minister since Margaret Thatcher. Her plain speaking style may be enough to bring the Conservatives together. May certainly shows no hesitation about the recent vote to leave the European Union.
Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it. Yeah. Together, we will build a better Britain. Thank you.
Theresa May meets the Queen officially later this week, and joining me is Edward Luce, U.S. columnist for the Financial Times. Does May represent anything in particular in terms of her outlook, her approach, her political style, or is she a bit of a blank card?
Somewhere in between. I mean, she very cautiously, minimally supported the Remain campaign, although she had a reputation for being a Eurosceptic. So she demonstrated loyalty to leadership, which is still important in the Conservative Party, but showed no enthusiasm for the Remain campaign. That stood her in very good stead in the chaos that's ensued since Brexit, the Brexit vote happened, to take over as party leader. And the efficiency, I think, sort of demonstrates a steeliness. The word steeliness is used a lot. She's an unknown quantity ideologically, though.
So you think she was working to get this position from the very early minutes after it was clear that the Brexit vote meant leaving the EU?
I suspect she was working for this position that the moment she made her choice far earlier this year to skeptically and passively support the Remain campaign. Because I think under the scenario that the Remain vote had won, she would have been seen as loyal and kept on in a senior position. And under the scenario where Brexit happened, which is what happened, she quite rightly envisaged chaos. And in chaos, people need a steady hand, and she is a steady hand. She's not particularly charismatic. She's not a brilliant orator. She keeps her cards close to her vest. But she's a clear, reliable, balanced individual. And there aren't too many of those around in the Conservative Party nowadays.
Is the mission here for May to reunite the Conservatives, will that be the priority for her? Or will it be a broader question of governance and reuniting the UK? And that would mean basically bringing people from various political bases back to a kind of newly reconstituted Conservative Party, at least as far as the British electorate is concerned.
She can't reunite the UK if she has a deeply divided Conservative Party. So that has to be her first priority. And the Conservative Party is overwhelmingly pro-Brexit. So she had little choice to say Brexit means Brexit and that she will negotiate Brexit. Unfortunately, that very act of unifying Conservatives will probably hasten the disintegration of the United Kingdom. If Theresa May triggers Article 50, which is the legal trigger for beginning the formal Brexit negotiations with the rest of Europe, that will almost certainly trigger Scottish moves to look to stay in the European Union by leaving the UK. And it's very, very hard to see how Theresa May can both unify the Conservative Party and keep the United Kingdom intact.
Edward Luce, U.S. columnist for the Financial Times. Thank you so much, Edward.
Thank you very much, John.
For California prison inmate Roberta Blake, a trip across the country to a jail in Alabama for just a moment seemed like a break from prison life.
When I stepped out of the Ventura jail facility and I looked at the van, I was expecting a bus. And I seen the van, I'm like, where are the restrooms?
Where are the restrooms or windows or seats that recline if we drive all night? Where, above all, were the prison staff uniforms? Roberta was in the custody of a private contractor with the job of transporting prisoners from one facility to another to extradition hearings across the country and back. She's being transported by PTS, the largest contractor by far for the massive prison population in the United States. If business is booming for PTS, Roberta said she couldn't tell that from inside her van.
It was pitch black. I had no clue who was behind me, next to me. I couldn't see anything. And the heat had already started to get to me. And I realized I'm going to be in this van. After I got in is when he said, it's going to be 10 days before we get to Kentucky to continue on to Alabama. And after an hour, I was like, there's no way I can make it 10 days like this. I was handcuffed, shackled together in this small section. I couldn't move. I couldn't turn. I couldn't sleep. And he informed us that every 3 days, they were required to stop at a jail and house us every 3 days.
Even though she was out of jail, Roberta Blake was in a mobile dungeon. She could barely keep track of the time of day. the dates of the month, of the week, from unheated windowless van to unheated windowless holding facility herded by the guards.
They were mean. They didn't care whether we had air conditioning. They didn't care whether we were thirsty. They didn't care if we had to go to the bathroom. If we spoke too loud, they would slam on their brakes and we would get jolted forward. We weren't seatbelted in or anything.
Roberta spent all told 2 weeks in this cramped, sensory-deprived environment. And one more thing. She was surrounded by male prisoners the whole time who were supposed to be segregated, but even that was a joke. A restraint was broken.
They were flirting, derogatory remarks, I mean, very vulgar, and made me very uncomfortable. However, after speaking with them and everybody realizing we're having to deal with this together, we kind of just came together and encouraged each other to get us through to the next stop.
These inmates had to come together, Roberta said, because of moments like these, degrading bathroom breaks with a paper cup in a moving van.
There I am, handcuffed and shackled. They wouldn't undo a cuff. They wouldn't anything. The van is moving, and I honestly had trouble pulling down my pants, and the guy next to me, granted, I'm supposed to be segregated. I'm in the segregation cage. However, they don't put a lock on it. So it was the other inmates were able to open and close it free will. And we had opened it and he pulled my pants down for me. I don't know him from Adam. He pulled my pants down for me as I peed in the cup, then held my cup as I wiped with napkins and gave me my cup back, and kind of the big joke was, don't drop the cup, as he was pulling my pants back up for me. Later, I find out one of the inmates in there was in there for rape.
Roberta's testimony is part of an investigation by the Marshall Project, which confirmed her story. Roberta was eventually convicted of a misdemeanor in Alabama for returning a rental car late, 3 weeks in jail, then back to California on a Greyhound bus. Eli Hager is a reporter for the Marshall Project who spoke with dozens of inmates and guards who had spent time on these private contractor vans.
We're talking about largely 15-passenger vans. Prisoners are crammed in there and they sit upright for days on end with no way to lie down to sleep. They're shackled at the wrists, waist, and ankles. There aren't bathrooms on board. They stop infrequently for bathrooms and food. So those are kind of the general conditions of the vans as they cross state lines.
Is there any regulation for how they're to be treated or how the vans are to be broken in terms of rests, rests for drivers, rests for inmates?
On those aspects of the industry, no, there is not a regulation. There is one law that's supposed to regulate the industry through some broad strokes, but that law is focused on preventing escape. So it says things like if a prisoner escapes, these companies have to notify local law enforcement right away. They have to dress the inmates in brightly colored clothing, some things like that to prevent escapes. But that law has only been enforced one time in the 16 years that it existed.
Now, the idea that a prisoner is not going to have like the wildest time of their life on a journey from one end of the country to the other is not going to find a whole lot of sympathy to some people who are listening. What do you say here about these conditions and how they don't meet a test that you think is appropriate and relevant?
Well, I would say a number of things. First of all, it's important to know that a number of the people on these vans have not yet been convicted of any crime,
right?
Because they're being brought to face charges. So these are people that are not convicted, although they are sitting on the van next to convicted murderers and convicted rapists, and they're all mixed together, and there's no organization by charge. So I think that's an important point that a lot of people understand. And I also think that there are more humane ways to do this. The business model is such that these van companies are driven to pack the vans with as many people as possible since they're paid per prisoner. And they're also incentivized to drive at all hours through the night for days on end because they're paid by the mile by the jurisdictions.
And these individuals who haven't been convicted of a crime are not in the custody of the state. They're in the custody of a private company.
They're in the custody of a private company, correct. And that raises a lot of jurisdictional questions. If there needs to be an investigation of an incident on one of the vans or accountability after the fact, there's a lot of finger pointing because Alabama will say, well, that was California's prisoner. And California will say, well, that was Alabama's prisoner. And they're crossing state lines. So it's in this kind of black hole of oversight and accountability.
How unusual is this story in your investigation?
It's actually not as unusual as it sounds. We spoke to a lot of people who had been on these vans, and we spoke to even more guards of these vans who acknowledged that things that Roberta had to do, such as urinating in cups and bottles in front of the other prisoners, very common from what we heard from talking to over 50 guards, and other things like the terrible heat and no ventilation or air conditioning, very common from what we heard by speaking to insiders, and even the conditions between men and women on the same van, something that we heard repeatedly from people we spoke with.
Eli Hager is a reporter for the Marshall Project. As for Roberta Blake, after her experience with PTS, she would probably take a stationary prison any day of the week, but mostly she never thought a Greyhound bus trip home would feel so good.
If white folks were to experience black sadness, it would be too overwhelming for them. Very few whites could take seriously black sadness and still live the lives that they live in.
Anna Deavere Smith heard activist and scholar Cornel West say those words back in 1992 in the aftermath of the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles and incorporated them into her one-woman play, Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. West would probably say much the same today. Others from Smith's oral history theater technique might have some new things to say. President Obama is part of the oral history in Dallas, where the deaths of five police officers is being commemorated today in an interfaith memorial service in the city. The president speaks to the lives and the loss of officers Thompson, Ahrens, Zamarripa, Smith, and Kroll, along with the lives of Philandro Castile and Alton Sterling, who were killed before them, and all of the many, many other lives who have been lost in moments of American violence, when American violence is often racial violence. Anna Deavere Smith says this is a unique challenge for this black president, convening the nation in a conversation where there are still some empty seats.
Well, I think the people who tend to be missing from this conversation, both in terms of where you're trying to talk and in the extremes of the events that we just saw happen in Dallas or Orlando, for that matter, or last year at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, is the psychologist and the psychiatrist, right? And there's not enough talk really about racial bias and what it means that we all have it. You know, that's the soft stuff on that side. How do we get to that? How do we build a moral imagination that defies something that's instinctual in human beings, you know, if we remain as animals? But the fact is, we live in very sophisticated societies with very sophisticated technologies and in a global society, and some among us have to get over it, that we don't like the people who are not like us, and that we have no empathy for those who are far behind. Some of us have to get over that.
Is it an equivalent corrosion going on in society that someone like Mr. Roof in Charleston can sit and think to himself, well, I'm going to kill black people because I have this need to justify my own unfortunate situation? And then there's a Micah Johnson who has his own feelings of, well, no, I'm going to kill white people because I have my own feelings of unfortunate circumstances related to my military record and that sort of thing. And the availability of guns means that anyone can act out whatever narrative they like.
They can act out whatever narrative they like. And I think that there is a matter of mental illness in both of these stories that you put together. I do think about Mr. Roof when I hear about Mr. Johnson.
And you know what he said? You know what he told the interrogators?
What?
He said, I almost didn't do it because they were so nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
Which means he was responding to empathy right there.
Right there.
Right there.
Right there. Right there. You know, that is I've never thought this through, John, so it's dangerous to say it right here. I just like you. See, wonder if there's a kind of a similarity, and I think the similarity has to do with mental illness. And the fact that we see people in our classrooms coming into our stores, and we pay no attention to behavior that may catch our eye. We just cast that out, too, as something that doesn't have to do with us, right? There is a big difference, isn't there? Because there was the people in Mother Emanuel were not players in
right.
any narrative whatsoever. But right. the police, and I'm certainly not justifying the murder of the police officers, the police are characters in a narrative, in a war, to some people, what some people would call a war. But these people in the basement of Mother Emanuel Church, which I visited as a part of my research for Notes from the Field doing time in education, these people were sitting in the cool basement of a church in the middle of what was likely a very humid day in South Carolina.
How does empathy and how does not allowing people who we think don't have anything to do with us go off to the corner and have their own angst? How do we prevent a Micah Johnson, for instance, from stewing in that way that he is? How do we say to him, wait, how do we pull him back? How do we pull Mr. Roof back? How do we do that?
It probably doesn't help that Micah Johnson served in the military. You know, it probably doesn't help at all. But that kind of pulling back that you're talking about has to start early. And I think our schools have an opportunity to be a part of that pulling back. You know, empathy is not the soft stuff. It really is the miracle that any of us can care about someone who's very different from us, because our instinct, I suppose, is a survival instinct to stay behind my closed door, in my fence. So we live in a very secular society. I think, I don't know who said that, you know, the most segregated time in America is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. So we have to find, I think, if we're serious about this notion of developing an empathic imagination or a moral imagination, we have to put that in institutions that do exist and build them up so that that can be a serious part of the enterprise.
What do you make of the demands on President Obama's empathy?
Well, I think that, you know, this really points to a very, very important question, John, which is much bigger than President Obama. And that has to do with, what does leadership require right now in these times? I mean, it feels almost impossible to me when you talk about the Bill Reilly's of the world who just over here kind of don't care. I don't know how you stand in a fractured country with so many different concerns and a fractured world for that matter. I just spent quite a bit of time from May until now in Europe. And I mean, you know what's going on there. I mean, I don't know what Obama can do except to continue to announce the need for compassion.
For folks like us who grew up in 1968, who sort of were at the barricades one way or another, is this the America that we wanted, what we have now in 2016, this segregated America? And how do we get here?
It's horrifying. It's horrifying. You know, when I looked this morning just briefly at a couple paragraphs of the Kerner Commission report, 1967, they warn how bad it's going to be, a divided society. We still have it. It's horrifying. I've been going around to these schools in the United States of America and on Indian reservations. The disparity between rich and poor is horrifying. I'm a professor at New York University. I teach excellent students. They inspire me, right? It's horrifying, the path that they've been on and the path of the young people that I'm meeting with potential cutoff, you know, visiting them in juvenile institutions and so forth. But let's not forget, one of the places, again, that we went was South Carolina and met the woman who signed the first petition for desegregation of the schools, which people don't realize is not Brown versus Board of Ed, was Briggs versus Elliott, a small town in South Carolina. What did she fight for? And what did people do in the South when they were forced by the law to make integrated schools? They made their own schools. They made small, private, religious schools so that they didn't have to go to school with black people. And so even though it's the soft stuff, we just can't get around the fact that, what do we do about the fact that we don't like being with one another?
I mean, my kids do not understand why blacks and whites aren't together. Do you think African-American kids the age of my kids have hope, have a sense of, this doesn't make any sense? Or do they go, are they actually much smarter about all this?
Well, I'm sure there's a statistic that's out already today that we could Google and find out. I don't know. I think it's dangerous to make generalizations. Mm-hmm. I think it's very dangerous to do that. I mean, one of the things I observe on the other side, you know, having for 40 years taught college students, is that I started teaching in 1973. I would say that my students, who are graduate students at NYU, are more inclined to want to be with people just like them. You know, and then these are kids who, you know, had a lot of advantages, even if it wasn't was money, it was something else. But they're more inclined to want to be with people who are just like them. And that's what we have to, I call it making the broad jump towards the other. And I you know, and if we look back at some of the old texts, Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, where he calls out, you know, Paul Tillich and Martin Buber, philosophers who are really asking us as humans to make our way away from segregation, to make our way way towards seeing every being across from us as a full human being. And we just haven't done that work. We may have put some laws in place, but as I mentioned, we could see how in the matter of desegregation of schools, you can escape those laws. We wish that our country would do something about guns. We'd like economists to come up with some better economic model, but that soft work, that work in the middle of just like
choosing.
Why is it? Choosing where I'm going to be with the people just like me, or am I going to go across, make that bridge across the chasm?
Broad jump to the other.
The broad jump towards the other.
Should be an event in the Olympics.
I think it's a broad jump towards the finish line. And that's the problem. That's the jump we mostly choose, is the broad jump towards the finish line. And there's another horizontal jump that some of us need to make. Not everybody has to make it, but some of us need to be making that jump, that horizontal jump.
Anna Deavere Smith, actress, playwright, and professor at New York University. You know her for her documentary style of plays and theater pieces on race in America. Twilight Los Angeles 1992 was produced after she arrived in Los Angeles a few weeks after the Rodney King riots. Her new play is called Notes from the Field, about education in the criminal justice system, opening this summer at Harvard, right?
And then at the Second Stage Theater in November in New York City.
Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you.
And to be a part of our oral history, a part of our conversation on any subject, on the country, where does it stand, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to facebook.com/The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.